thanks so much for agreeing to speak with me. And I wanted to start off by asking you a little bit about your background, where you're from, your education, your career, etc.
Okay, I was born and raised in Mount Holly, New Jersey, which is 20 miles from Philadelphia.
Okay.
And across the river from Burlington, where Pearl Buck wrote The Good Earth. I was born August 23rd, 1914, which makes me 92. I had an ordinary life there in Mount Holly, in one sense, but another sense not, because my folks didn't go to church. So I never went to church as a boy. We didn't talk about it. I knew the people did.
Nice.
And also, I had one sister and three brothers. None of them finished high school. They didn't care about education. They didn't teach me to read and write. And so at 7 years of age, I went to first grade, which is what you did. When you became seven, you went to first grade. And I enjoyed learning the ABCs and how to count 1, 2, 3. And so I was always a good student. I studied a lot. I liked learning. I had a long series of good teachers. I remember every one of them from first grade on, Miss McLean on through. A real Southern girl named Miss Foster from Georgia. I claim I'm from Southern New Jersey, farming country. As a boy, 6, 7, 8, 10, 12, 15, I worked on the local farms, stole watermelons at night. Well, I graduated from high school in 1932. And nobody went to college. 49 students in class, 30 girls and 19 boys. Nobody went to college, and not a single one of my teachers, who were all very good, from Penn State and Drexel and around Northern New Jersey. No one single teacher ever mentioned going to college. We didn't have any money. It was the Great Depression of 1929. And so nobody had a job. The local girls married the local boys. I wasn't interested in that. The local boys didn't go to college. A lot of them were bright, but they followed in their father's footstep. A young one man, Lord, took over his father's dental practice. Another fellow took over his father's undertaking business. Another one inherited the water plant. It was owned privately from an artesian well. They pumped the water from an artesian well up to the top of the mountain and let it run down into the town. And so none of them ever went to college. I worked at a local milk dairy across the street from where I lived. Made a few, little bit of money. But after about a year, I said to myself one day, you better find some way to get to college, because otherwise you're going to be a bum standing around on the street corner like all your buddies are, because nobody had a job. So I rode around to the country to 100 different colleges, public and private. And I wanted a place that was in the mountains away from home. Traveling was no problem because my father was a conductor on the Pennsylvania Railroad and could get me a free ride. And he didn't have to go to war because of World War I, because he was carrying people and goods into Fort Dix, New Jersey, which was 12 miles away. So, I wanted a place that was cheap because I didn't have any money. And I found out that the University of Arkansas had no out-of-state tuition. They put it in 30s. I went to college there in 34. They put in out-of-state tuition in 36, but they did not make it ex post facto, so I never paid any out-of-state tuition. And tuition and fees was $15 a month, which is a lot of money in 1934-38, a lot of money. I got a job on Roosevelt's Work-Study Administration, 25 cents an hour. That was maximum wage, was 25 cents an hour. That's a lot of money. So, I graduated in 1938 and had begun looking to go to graduate school. I was a good student. I always made A's, and I admired my professors, and sort of indicated I ought to go to graduate school. I did turn down a job with the Fish and Wildlife Service to go down to Arkansas, where the ivory-billed woodpecker has been seen. I didn't go. So I almost went to Michigan, because I had a professor at Arkansas named Chandler that was from there, and I was much interested in what was called the microcrustacea. I remember the day that he went out in the woods to a pond and threw a net out, dragged it through the water, and found out all these little wiggly things in there that I didn't know was in the water. I took to that, and I liked studying them. But the other thing, the reason I went to Arkansas, was because they had a course there teaching birds, a course in ornithology, because I had become an ornithologist. One day when I was a sophomore, I was out in the woods knocking around like I used to do. I heard this beautiful song to me. I looked up and I saw this thing which I was able to identify as a mourning dove. And it was mourning. So I went back to school and told my high school sophomore biology teacher about it. And she said, "Well, good. You like birds? Go down to see Mr. Pumier in the Union Bank downtown." This little town got 7,000 people in it. "You tell him about it, because he's a bird man." And so I did. And Mr. Pumier says, "Well, all right, I belong to the Delaware Valley Ornithological Club, which meets in Philadelphia once a month. I'm going next week. I'll take you with me." And so I went. And that was a revelation. I didn't ever know any professional men except the family doctor and the family dentist, the undertaker. We didn't associate with the uptown people, as we called them. So the Delaware Valley Ornithological Club, meeting in the Philadelphia Academy of Sciences. Ben Franklin was gone by then.
So
they took big field trips, especially spring migration, to Cape May, New Jersey. And So I went along. And lo and behold, I met all these bankers and lawyers and doctors and businessmen and members, rich members of the Old Line Philadelphia families, a whole raft of professional men. Well, that was a revelation to me. You're interested in birds. I'm all excited about identifying different kinds of birds, so I thought that was pretty good. I better go on and try to be a bird watcher. So that's when I came on back around and decided to go to the University of Arkansas, because among other things, they had the course in ornithology. So in 1938, when I was graduating, my professor at Arkansas, Dr. Berg, a German B-E-R-G, Berg, received a call from Dr. Metcalf saying, hey, we just put in a new curriculum here. We're going with the times. The environment's becoming a matter of concern. The word ecology has come into being. Environmental science is important. And we're putting in a curriculum in wildlife conservation and management. And we need somebody to come here and help us teach the ornithology course. Now, do you have anybody? And Dr. Berg says, yeah, I've got a walk-on. He just came in here from Philadelphia, New Jersey. He's been helping me teach ornithology. Metcalf says, send him over. No graduate record exams, no SAT scores, no letter of recommendation, just one old buddy to another old buddy. He says, send him over. Metcalf was head of the zoology entomology department. And so I came. And so I started teaching, helping to teach ornithology. Pretty soon I was teaching ornithology. I was a graduate student teaching graduate students. And then I was teaching Metcalf's courses because he was busy administrator. Big man, important, doing major research, administrator and a dean. So when I was graduating in 1948 with my PhD, I got the first PhD ever given at NC State in zoology. They call it ecology. So Chapel said, you can't do it in zoology. That's pure stuff, and you can't have the pure stuff. You're the technical place at NC State. Okay. When I was graduating, I said, well, Dr. Metcalf, I guess I need your help to get a job, Dr. Metcalf. I guess I'm going to graduate. Yeah, he says, you stay here. I don't want to teach my courses anymore. And so I stayed. And so I was on the faculty all the way, you might say, from 38 to 1980 when I retired at 65. It reminds me of a story about Wells. At that time, you had to retire at 65. If you wanted to go on until 70 and they let you do it, they'd give you a one-year contract. But you're susceptible to not being rehired. And you lost your retirement benefits. And Metcalf says, hell no, I'm not going to do that. I'll take my chances 1 year at a time. Which he did. And so he went on until 70. And that was compulsory then for sure. Then you couldn't go past 70. And so I was his special friend. He was on my graduate committee. I would go on field trips with him. Go out to the farm. He was so proud of that, having built his own outdoor study and the trail around to the big rock. Over the noose and around, he built that. He built the wall around his house. There they are.
Those are
the two best ones.
Those are Wells's.
That's
paintings.
The big rock. Oh yeah, that's the big rock. And this is his house. And that's his first watercolor painting, of Falls of the Noose in watercolor before he shifted to oils. You've got about 100 of his paintings.
Yes, sir. A lot of them. How, in a general way, would you describe Wells's impact?
Say that again?
How would you describe Wells's impact?
His impact?
Yes, sir.
Well, it was intense. It was intense in several major ways. He wrote that Natural Gardens because he wanted to educate the people of the state to what a great state they had ecologically, environmentally. And he established what the plant communities were. That was certainly a public service. On students, he had a big impact. His courses were very popular. They crowded, struggled to get in. Plant ecology was so big, they had two different sections, 40 students each. Shunk taught one section, and Wells taught the other section. But they put them all together when they took their three-day field trip to the coast. Or they go to the mountains, up on the Balds and Klingman's Dome, and they'd go down east to the coast, go all through the coastal zone, spend 3 days, take all 80 of them. I remember one day we were going around White Lake. And here these 80 students all strewn out behind him. I was right up close to him. He stopped and turned around and snapped his eyes. He snatched off his glasses and looked at you real intense, very intense. He said, "Come on, you guys. Keep up with me. You know, I'm getting too old for this. I'm already 56. He went on to 94. I believe it was. I recall one field trip in advanced ecology we took with a bunch of graduate students. He didn't take graduate students unless they were doing research with him, and he had a number of them. But we went down to through Lake Matamuskeet, out through the open grounds, taking samples of the soil, looking for the muck and stuff underneath and out to Nag's Head. Come Saturday night, we went to the Nag's Head dance. And he was very popular. He had a tremendous sense of rhythm. And the women just lined up, struggling to get a dance with B.W. Wells. And he obliged as many as he could. Come midnight, we were camping out on this field trip. We weren't staying in hotels or anything. So we went out on the sands of Nag's Head, threw our blankets down on the upper beach, and slept the rest of the night. Out there with the wind and the waves.
So did you have a long professional working relationship with Wells?
The whole time. When I first came in 38, I reported in September 1st, 1938, to Dr. Metcalf. And then I went across the triangle to Patterson Hall to see Dr. Wells, because Wells had been at Arkansas from 17 to 19, I believe. Then he came here. And my professor at Arkansas, Dr. Berg, says, "When you get over to Raleigh, NC State, you go see Dr. Wells, because he is a live wire." So he was always very much alive, just kind of shaking with energy. He was on my graduate committee. I took his advanced courses. We were friends. I went out to the Rock. My wife and I would go to visit frequently, often two or three times a week. Go out and eat supper with him.
This was after was he still a member of the faculty at this point?
Well, yeah, I think he retired about 1950. I believe it would have been when Cooper came.
Right, okay.
We just stayed friends. We liked each other. So we visited frequently. Right up to the day he died, we visited with together. So, we like to go out there, drive out over this way around, and out that way, and go to this place, yeah. So that's about how that went. Yeah, we stayed friends just because we liked each other. They approved of my bird watching. I approved of their being plant ecologists and artists and just good friends, that's all. We spoke the same language. Did you ever hear that story about when he was on the Big Savannah?
I'm not sure. Which story?
Down east here in the Big Savannah.
Yes, sir.
When he was studying the plant community, he was enthralled. You know, he was an artist studying bacteria and algae and illustrating them before he came here.
Right.
But he found out about the natural communities of North Carolina and studied them and established what they were, and then wrote the book and all. He went and did all his research in all these places. But to tell the story of being on the Big Savannah down east in the grassy country there, which has been preserved recently, he was naked to the waist, and he was digging in the soil, taking soil samples, looking at the plants, at the roots. So he'd lean over and disappear, and then he'd get up, and all you could see was this man in the grass. People seeing him from town, out there looking at him, thought he was a crazy man. He was naked. So they called up the police and all and said, there's a crazy naked man out there in the savannah. You better go get him. He loved to tell that story. He was only naked from the waist up. Yeah.
Okay. You mind if I just change the tapes out really quickly?
Yeah.